tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Ira Melm, and the wait continues to reveal an international vote on a climate change agreement. The wait continues for the results of a vote on whether or not over 190 delegates from countries around the world will accept or reject a long-awaited plan to slow global warming following almost 2 weeks of strenuous negotiations. Delegates have gathered at the conference center outside of Paris, heralding the climate deal as an historic turning point. The French Foreign Minister, Laurent Fabius, said the proposal will limit global warming to well below 2 degrees Celsius, possibly even as low as 1.5 degrees. We hear him through a translator.
This agreement will serve major causes: food security and production, public health, combating poverty, essential rights, and ultimately peace.
Fabio said the text would be legally binding and sets five-year reviews of national plans for curbing global warming. That would include at least $100 billion in annual climate change financing for developing countries. He said there has been opposition to the plan expressed by some, but others like Emma Ruby Sachs of the Avas online activist movement likes what they have heard and read so far.
When I read it, what I thought is, I am witnessing a moment in history. This text, especially the what they're calling the long-term goal, which is this idea that we're going to hit net zero emissions in the second half of the century, and what that means is that we have a path to 100% clean energy. That's what everyone was marching for before this climate conference. It's what 3.6 million people are calling for. It's a huge deal. It's what ends the fossil fuel era.
This is VOA News. 87 people, including 8 security forces, were killed during coordinated attacks on 3 military bases in Burundi's capital, according to an army spokesman. The final toll of Friday's attacks left 79 enemies killed, 45 captured, and 97 weapons seized. Colonel Gaspard Bartuza said that, adding that on the government side, 8 soldiers and policemen were killed and 21 wounded. In another incident, at least 20 dead bodies were found on the streets of Burundi's capital Saturday. The bodies were found in Bujumbura's Nyakabiga neighborhood. It was not immediately clear who killed the people. One eyewitness told the Associated Press that some of the victims had their hands tied behind their backs. Women have been voting and running for office for the first time ever in Saudi Arabia. The breakthrough came in municipal elections held across the kingdom Saturday. The late King Abdullah ruled 4 years ago that Saudi Arabia's electoral process would be broadened to include women, and the current round of balloting is the first implementation of his decision. Edward Uranian reports for VOA from Cairo.
This voter said she does not believe that it's a woman's place to run for office. She feels that men are better suited for a career in politics. Not all Saudi women agreed with that assessment, however. One woman who wanted to run for a council seat but was denied permission to do so told Al Hora television that some women's names were mysteriously removed from official lists of candidates. Human Rights Watch reported it was difficult for women to register to vote, noting that women are not allowed to drive cars in Saudi Arabia. The rights group also said many polling stations were too far from women's houses. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
Yemen's internationally recognized government and Shiite rebels, who have controlled the capital Sana'a since September of last year, agreed today, Saturday, to start a week-long ceasefire on the eve of direct talks in Geneva. President Abed Rabo Mansour Hadi will order his commanders to halt all fire 5 minutes before midnight Monday, according to officials in Hadi's office, who spoke on condition of anonymity because they were not authorized to brief reporters. We have agreed to the ceasefire to lift the suffering of our people and to deliver humanitarian assistance to them, said a spokesman for the Shiite rebels known as the Houthis. And Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's dog is behind bars after biting a lawmaker and a cabinet minister's husband during an event to mark the Jewish holiday of Hanukkah. I'm Ira Melman, reporting from Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clawty in Washington.
Know all this, but you know there is a new secretariat that went to Vietnam after the secretariat was actually dissolved last month.
The South Sudanese presidential spokesman denies President Salva Kiir is to blame for the postponement of the ruling party's meeting this weekend.
We cannot be a party of continuous success if we get divided.
Zimbabwean President Robert Mugabe faces trouble within his party as members jostle to succeed him.
We are worried, certainly, that the deals are being made, especially country by country, saying, look, this is what you get if you do indeed stop refugees from coming to Europe.
And the European Union is trying to use foreign aid to end the flow of more than 200,000 African migrants into Europe. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. The South Sudanese presidential spokesman has denied President Salva Kiir is to blame for postponing a meeting of senior officials of the ruling Sudan People's Liberation Movement, SPLM, scheduled for this weekend. The party is expected to meet in January next year. Attorney Wekateni also dismissed media reports that some of the delegates wanted to remove President Kiir as the leader of the party ahead of the next general election.
No, it's not President Salva Kiir canceling it. Rather, it is the SPLM secretariat that has cancelled it owing to the organizations that they wanted to do in order to transport the delegates of the 2008 to Juba. So those delegates are scattered all over South Sudan, and so resources need to be mobilized in order to bring any delegate that was appointed to the convention, to the second national convention in 2008. So that's the procedure. It is procedural and technical, so it has nothing to do with President Salva Kiir canceling it.
Was there a failure in planning because the SPLM was well aware of these challenges before putting out the date for this weekend for this meeting?
No, the SPLM know all this, but you know there is a new secretariat that just took over after the secretariat was actually dissolved last month. First of all, the question was, you know, whether the delegates comprising of the extraordinary conventions would be drawn from, would be freshly elected, or the 2008 you know delegates were to be bought. And so the decision was made that the 2008 delegates should be the one to participate in an extraordinary national conventions, and therefore mobilizing resources is a challenge, but the SPLM will manage to bring the delegate not later than the third week of January.
Some people have said that the SPLM came under pressure from President Salva Kiir to call off this meeting because there were suggestions that he could be challenged at this meeting and he could be dropped from leading the party in next year's election. And that is why he made a move to have this election postponed in order to adequately prepare for it. What do you say to that?
You know, this is not true. The only person in South Sudan who doesn't fear to take on contest, to contest the election, is President Salva Kiir. He knows he commands popularity, and therefore he is the last person to fear election. So these are just distractors trying to just belittle the steadfast leadership of President Salva Kiir, and there's no more than that.
Well, some of the SPLM stalwarts have said, although they have not come out to say publicly, are suggesting that he has failed as a leader, he has plunged South Sudan into crisis that has yet to be resolved, and that there has to be a change, and that because of him, there are divisions within the SPLM. What do you say to such criticisms as a spokesman?
You know, it's human to see a certain group of people, trying to lay down or try to enforce the significant aspect of what a given leader has done. And President Salva Kiir is a record. He has done what people of South Sudan want a leader to do. And South Sudan became South Sudan because Salva Kiir is a leader. We never talked about all this. They are just doing it as a smear campaign. You know, because some people wanted to be in power, you know, and of course is a constitutional right for any citizen. Only that they are not waiting for the election; they should wait and challenge the president during the election so that they can beat him in the election if they think that he will be beaten in an election. But problem is that, you know, majority of those who think that they cannot get into power, they are just using guns and bullets to intimidate. So President Salva Kiir is electable, and if the South Sudanese are available another opportunity to elect their leader, they will elect President Salva Kiir.
Will the SPLM be able to meet this financial and logistical challenges that forced the meeting to be postponed until January?
Definitely, the SPLM will make it. You know, SPLM is supposed to be one of the very rich political parties. Given that it has more than 3 million members. And if members pay their subscription fees, SPLM will not be any problems, you know, financially. So this is a matter of mobilization. You know, they go out and mobilize resources from members, and it will be able to sponsor the convention. Comes the early January 2016, they will be able to do that. I have no doubt.
Attorney Wek Attorney is the South Sudanese presidential spokesman. He spoke with me from the capital, Juba. After 2 years of war, the International Committee of the Red Cross, or ICRC, warns hundreds of thousands of people in South Sudan are facing severe food shortages, with many at the point of starvation. For VOA, Lisa Schlein reports from ICRC headquarters in Geneva.
The International Committee of the Red Cross warns the level of hunger in South Sudan is alarmingly high, and many people are in desperate need of medical care. The Swiss humanitarian organization says for many people, the last 2 years have been a life on the run in search of food and health care and away from the dangers of warfare and sexual assault. Florence Gillette, ICRC Operations Coordinator for South Sudan, has just returned from a mission to that country. She tells VOA the ongoing fighting between the government and rebel forces has displaced more than 1.7 million South Sudanese in remote areas. She says many are effectively in hiding.
Hiding in the bush, on islands, sometimes on makeshift islands, that they have made to stay out of reach of any attacks. These people are not feeling safe enough to return to their area of origin, to their home. They are grouped in small groups in those hard-to-reach areas, and they actually fled for their life and for their physical integrity.
Gillette says the ICRC and other aid groups can occasionally provide these displaced people with food, but she says not enough is reaching them, and many are barely surviving on what they can gather in the forests and the fields. As a consequence, she says, malnutrition levels are extremely high in many areas. She says providing medical care is practically impossible in some places. She notes there are many war wounded, and right now people are particularly at risk of malaria and respiratory infections.
It's difficult to say how many people are dying of those diseases because we can only work in some pockets because we don't have the means to cover the whole areas.
The warring parties signed a peace agreement earlier this year. Unfortunately, the ICRC says violence persists and the humanitarian consequences of 2 years of conflict remain of great concern. Besides the massive food needs, the agency says many people are separated from their loved ones with little hope of returning to the homes they have fled. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
At least 10 students are said to have been killed and hundreds injured this week. The students were reportedly killed protesting against a controversial proposal known as the Master Plan to expand the capital Addis Ababa into surrounding Oromia State, which they say will threaten local farmers with mass evictions. Mohamed Ademo is an Ethiopian journalist with Al Jazeera America who has been following the development in Addis Ababa. My colleague Douglas Impuga reached him in Washington for an update on the protests.
The current situation is that the students have been protesting for almost 3 weeks now, and it doesn't seem to be slowing down. So we are seeing an expansion on almost daily basis. So the protests and the resistance has reached up to about 36 towns and almost all major universities in Ethiopia, 36 towns in the Oromia state. And the students are engaging in different forms of resistance. They are doing sit-ins, and they are walking out of lunch and walking out of classes, boycotting meetings and other things. So it seems like the situation is going from bad to worse as the government has deployed heavily armed security forces in almost all of the towns where protests have been reported. We have seen pictures of heavily armed police in military convoys patrolling towns and in some cases firing tear gas and live ammunition at protesters. And we are also hearing reports today that actually about 5 to 6 more people have been killed in addition to the 7 or 10 that have been reported in the past.
The cause of this whole problem is what is described as the master plan or where the capital is supposed to be expanding. How has it become contentious?
The plan was designed by the federal government and is being pushed from top down to the people and to the local towns in the Oromia state. So part of the problem is that the stakeholders, the Oromo people in the Oromia government, were not at the table. At least the people feel that the people who are involved in the designing of the master plan were not the true representative of the people, and the plan will displace millions of Oromo farmers with little to no compensation, which means that you will sell your land or you will be moved from your land and given a small amount of money in the form of compensation, if you are even given that, which you would spend on providing for your family, and you become homeless. And you turn around and work for development companies for a very small pay. This is one of the problems. The other problem is that the Oromos are original to this land, and they attach so much value, so much importance to the land. So the plan, by expanding, will not just displace but also dismantle their cultural roots. Now, the issues are very complex. Obviously, this is just a trigger, but you know, the young people in Ethiopia today feel increasingly not valued enough, and they don't feel like the government is investing too much in their future, because most of the investment is going to mega development projects. There is massive unemployment. The young people are graduating and not finding jobs, because finding a job requires membership in the ruling party. So the issues are very complex, but these are some of the triggers, some of the things that the protesters are asking the government. But essentially, it becomes a question of self-rule, because the constitution is ethnic-based. So these are some of the ongoing discontent that we are seeing that is feeding into the protests as the protests expand far, far beyond the surrounding Addis Ababa area.
That was Mohamed Ademo, an Ethiopian journalist with Al Jazeera. He spoke with my colleague Douglas Impuga from Washington. Zimbabwean President Robert Mugabe is facing trouble within his own party as members jostle to succeed the 91-year-old leader. For VOA, Sebastian Nhofu reports from Victoria Falls, where the ruling party is holding its annual conference.
President Robert Mugabe got a warm welcome at the ZANU-PF annual conference, but he had a stern message to deliver. In his speech, he lamented corruption among officials and went on for long periods condemning factionalism in Zimbabwe.
Let's stop that completely. We are ruining the party that way. Let's be orderly, let's be systematic. We cannot be a party of continuous success if we get divided. For as they say, divided we fall. United we stand.
Mugabe has run Zimbabwe since independence in 1980. He turns 92 in February, but he has not indicated when or if he will throw in the towel or designate a successor. There are two main factions in the ZANU-PF vying to replace Mr. Mugabe. One faction is led by his wife, Grace, the other by Vice President Emmerson Mnangagwa. Mnangagwa became president a year ago after Grace Mugabe helped to force out his predecessor, Joyce Mujuru. In his speech Friday, which lasted close to 2 hours, President Mugabe condemned the West for what he called exploitation of Africa's resources. He said Africa's hopes lie with countries like India and China. Earlier this month, China's President Xi Jinping paid a two-day visit to Zimbabwe, during which he and Mugabe signed economic deals totaling more than $1 billion. Sebastian Mhofu for VOA News, Victoria Falls, Zimbabwe.
The European Union is trying to use foreign aid to end the flow of more than 200,000 African migrants into Europe. The European Union offered a $2 billion trust fund to sub-Saharan African leaders at a summit on the island of Malta early last month. Some observers say if that's how they plan to reduce the traffic across the Mediterranean, it won't work. VOA's David Arnold has more.
Deputy Director of Amnesty International's Europe and Central Asia Office, Gary Van Gulik, says the negotiations that took place with individual countries raise many questions.
We are worried, certainly, that the deals are being made, especially country by country, saying, look, this is what you get if you do indeed stop refugees from coming to Europe. We're worried about border guards being funded by the EU in certain countries. We're concerned that we're going to see camps in African countries to keep people away from Europe. That's not quite happening yet. So we're going to follow this and monitor it. But slightly removed from that is the notion that as long as you give a lot of development aid to certain countries, you're going to prevent movement. Don't pretend that you're going to stop people fleeing conflict, fleeing persecution, just because the standard of living may have gone up a little bit. Frankly, this is all about keeping people out. In the end, this is what it's about.
EU officials say these development aid packages will likely lower migrant flows from Nigeria, Mali, Eritrea, and Ethiopia, but an African development expert says it won't work unless it's in the best interests of the governments. Stephen Radelet is an economist and a professor of the practice of global development at Georgetown University in Washington, D.C. In his book, The Great Surge, The Ascent of the Developing World, Radelet writes about how development aid affects African economies. But he doesn't think this development aid package from the EU will keep Africans out of Europe.
It's certainly correct, I think, that that's a good way to interpret it. For that reason, I don't think it's going to work. One of the things that we've learned is that you cannot give countries money to ask them to do what is not in their basic interest. You can use aid to help push countries move faster and to help support them in what they want to do. That is, if they really do want to strengthen their health system or their education system. But when we ask countries to do things that they wouldn't actually put as a top priority, providing strings with aid money is just not going to work.
He says remittances are another factor working against a slowdown in migration. The funds that Somalis, Nigerians, and Ethiopians earn in the United States and in Europe and then send home to their families boost the national economies of those African countries.
Migrants leaving and then earning money that they send as remittances back home is beneficial to the countries and to their families. What the EU is asking countries to do is to stop doing that and to use resources to stop people from doing that that they might otherwise use for education or health or other social structures.
Radulet says the European Union has been a generous provider of development funds to Africa, but he says the $2 billion offered at the Malta summit are not enough.
Well, the EU has a long history of aid to Africa, starting in the post-colonial period, that has come both from the EU itself and from its member countries on a range of topics, from health to education to economic growth. The current amount is relatively small. I don't think it's conceived particularly well, and I actually don't think it's going to get at the root cause of the problems. And in fact, no amount of aid by itself is going to turn many of these countries around. The problems are rooted in difficulties in governance and other structures that aid alone can't remedy. It could help, but it can't remedy it by itself.
He says 19 countries in Africa are improving their economies. The rest are not. The difference is governance. Migrants tend to leave countries where the governance is not good.
The real solution is improving conditions at home. The countries in the worst shape are the least likely to use aid well, but they're the most likely to have migrants leaving. Sudan is a perfect example. It's a place that's not governed very well, and providing them with aid, the aid is unlikely to be used well, and therefore it's unlikely to turn things around. So I think for those reasons, the trust fund is likely to be ineffective.
Governance is not the only driver causing migrants to cross the Mediterranean. They're also looking for work, even when their own country's economies are growing.
There are lots of opportunities at home for Ethiopia. The economy is growing very fast. It's such a big country, however, that even though Ethiopia is doing fairly well, there are not as many opportunities for others as there might be. Nigeria is perhaps turning the corner politically with the very successful elections that they had earlier this year, but they are struggling economically because the price of oil is down. In the other countries, Mali, Eritrea, and in Sudan, there's a longer history of lackluster economic performance, and of course in Mali, accentuated by the recent bombings in Bamako. So people do not see great opportunities, economic opportunities at home, and all of their incentives are to move to other countries in Europe where there are better job opportunities.
It's not clear if European leaders will respond to critics and restructure their $2 billion aid plan, but Radulet is sure that without changes, the effort is not likely to achieve its goals. This is VOA's David Arnold in Washington, D.C.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa, Pope Francis recently took his message of religious tolerance to Kenya, Uganda, and the Central African Republic. Tune in to Straight Talk Africa next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC when host Shaka Sali and his guests discuss interfaith solutions to combat religious intolerance and extremism. That's next time on VOA Africa. Next on Let's Talk. First love. Do you remember yours? Are you still in touch? Or is it now history? Join host Sandy Shomari and his guests discussing First Love. This lighthearted show covers topics of your interest. Let's Talk comes to you Mondays at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
When news breaks, VOA News is there.
VOA.
Around the clock, listen to VOA newscasts on the top of each hour, along with our detailed news shows and analysis.
VOA News. We're online at voanews.com.
At voanews.com.
VOA, your trusted source of news and information.
You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. Then we'll have commentary by Dr. Suleiman Nyang, Professor of African Studies and Comparative Politics at Howard University. And right now it's time for music from our African collection. Enjoy what we have for you today.
Love you, Joanie. really such a cutie. You're killing me softly with your beauty. I'm loving your booting. So break up for me like a broomstick.
Is it the way that you want? Go, baby. I feel I'm a kilo day, oh, baby. I Africa lady, oh.
Aye,
see. I sing in the song for Panya.
Aye.
And I dance in the dance for Panya, oh. I would do anything for Panya.
Anything, yeah.
And I thank you the Lord for Panya,
hey. Aye, what is my baby name?
Panya, Panya, oh, Panya.
Aye, what is your baby name?
Panya, Panya, oh,
Panya. Anything, yeah. I request for my baby girl.
She's my fine baby, baby, oh, she's my African lady,
lady, oh,
my Panya sweet like a chocolate. When she come around, she a heavyweight. She a dance, she a move, immediate, baby, yeah, yeah.
Aya, what is my baby name?
Panya, Panya, oh, Panya.
Aya, what is your baby name?
Panya, Panya, oh, Panya.
I request for my baby girl.
Panya,
Panya scatter the flow for me.
Panya, Panya, oh, Panya.
And that was music from the continent. We hope you enjoyed it. It's now time for commentary and analysis by Dr. Suleiman Nyang, Professor of African Studies and Comparative Politics at Howard University here in Washington. Hello, Dr. Nyang.
Hello, Africa. It is always a pleasure to share my reflections on American foreign policy towards Africa. Simultaneously, I pay close attention to African opinions on and attitudes towards the United States. This week, there are many stories relating to U.S. policy towards Africa. The United States has diplomatic relationship with 54 African states. The key issue for the U.S. right now is reverberation of political decisions on the part of American leaders, particularly people who are eyeing for the presidency of the United States. This is a very important position in American history and now in world history. When a candidate for the presidency of the United States makes a statement about one part of the population, i.e. Muslims, coming to the United States, that becomes a big issue for American foreign policy. Not against all Americans, but against an individual who aspires to be the head of the United States. During the Cold War, Italian journalists who were watching events around the world, particularly in these United States, were very concerned about Barry Goldwater when he was running for the president of the United States. They were also concerned about Lyndon Baines Johnson, who was the vice president to President Kennedy, and he too was going to be elected as a vice president or could be the president of the United States. Le Figaro, the Italian newspaper, came with a very interesting headline. Tomorrow, the Americans are going to elect the Emperor of the West. Being Italians, we are very much concerned about the echoes of ancient Rome. They were trying to remind Americans the sensitivity of their narrative and the implication of who they were going to elect president. Here we go again. As Reagan used to say, we now come to the problem of Donald Trump as a candidate for the president of the United States and his echoes about Muslims coming to America. This is a big foreign policy implication for the United States and the Muslim world. And this brings back memory of many prominent American scholars, journalists, and now bloggers who are engaged in this new narrative from Donald Trump. 3 points need to be underlined in this narrative. Number one, just like Italians were talking about LBJ being the new emperor of the West, Donald Trump is now being compared to all the American candidates for the presidency and other leaders elsewhere in the world. What comes to mind to many Jewish scholars, journalists, bloggers who are on the internet and around the world, the Hitler narrative came to light to some, depending on their perspectives on this candidate from the United States. Of course, from the Israeli side, some of them had echoes of Hitler and being elected as a Democrat and the consequences for Jewish history. The rest is the Holocaust and the narrative we talk about. Immediately, Donald Trump came with his narrative. You have echoes all over the world. Just like when the late Samuel Huntington wrote his famous essay, which talked about class of civilization. And that also triggered a big debate about American policy. Not only does that policy affect America's relations with people around the world, in this particular case, the Islamic world, when Huntington came with his narrative, class of civilization, it affected not Muslims, but all other groups who are non-Western, because he divided humanity into six categories. He was ambivalent about the Africans, and he said maybe Africa, because Africa was that undecided contestant for the class of civilization, because the Africans were compromised between some of the Western groups and the Islamic groups. I was one of the intellectuals invited by Colorado College. Seven of us scholars were the ones who took him to task, where he gave the keynote speech, and then the rest is history. Those who are interested can go back to Colorado College and look at how people responded to Samuel Huntington. Several books came out of the debate. Now we look at Donald Trump and echoes of his statements for the American presidency, and how this is going to affect Africa. And that's the way it is today. When we look at U.S. foreign policy towards Africa and African opinions on and attitudes towards these United States.
Thank you very much, Dr. Nyang. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, managing editor Shaka Sali, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Odette Frazier, and our engineer for today, the affable Greg Burns. We say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, don't make a goat your friend if your skirt is made of leaves. I'm your host, Peter Clotte in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
On a recent visit to Ukraine, Vice President Joe Biden acknowledged the economic and political reforms the country has made over the past year. He also stressed the need to complete the reform process and announced a planned additional $190 million in U.S. assistance, pending consultation with Congress, to help Ukraine get the job done. These new funds will help Ukraine advance reforms, fight corruption, and attract more investment by streamlining regulations and privatizing state-owned enterprises in a transparent way. In addition, the assistance will increase Ukraine's capacity for trade and improve access to capital for small and medium-sized enterprises, strengthen energy security, and support civil society and independent media. It is critical that corruption be permanently rooted out of the political culture of Ukraine. As Vice President Biden said, the Ukrainian people cannot once again have their hopes dashed based on the cancer of corruption. Vice President Biden also reaffirmed that the U.S. continues to stand firmly with the people of Ukraine in the face of ongoing aggression from Russia and Russian-backed separatists. The U.S. continues to believe that the best way to end the conflict in the eastern Ukrainian region of Donbass is through a framework laid out in the Minsk Agreement. It is incumbent on Russia to fully implement the Minsk Agreement and work constructively with Ukraine to create the conditions for free, fair, and safe local elections in Donbass. On Crimea, said Vice President Biden, let me be absolutely clear. The illegal invasion by Russia of Crimea will not be accepted by us or the international community. This attempted annexation is contrary to international law, is wrong, and we will not accept it under any circumstance. Ukraine is on the cusp, said Vice President Biden. What happens in the next year is likely to determine the fate of the country for generations. It is up to Ukraine's leaders to work together in order to ensure that Ukraine goes down the path of Euro-Atlantic integration, democracy, and economic prosperity.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.